Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli, of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me welcoming my co-host, fresh from the set of the Jersey Shore, South Beach Edition, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mikey, how you doing,
bud? I'm doing well. How you doing?
Good. I feel like they should have done the Jersey Shore in Jersey, especially now that Smarek's going
to
be there.
Yeah, that would seem to make sense.
They could call it Jersey Shore, like the new schools edition.
But they're going back to Jersey. They're making a so-called season three.
And I think they're going to work for the Jersey Department of Ed. They're going to be turnaround specialists. Ooh. It's going to be, can't you see episode two? Hi, I'm Snooki. I'm here to turn you guys around.
I like it.
She's going to turn a lot of guys' eyes around.
And Mike's going to be like, yo, here's the situation. Huh?
So, Rick, I just have goosebumps here. You know why? Not because of Snooki, but because you're back. We missed you, Ricky.
I missed you, baby.
It has been a long time.
It's been like 2 months.
Though I have to say, Rick, we had some pretty darn good shows while you were gone. Yeah. I mean, Janie was freaking phenomenal last week. And, well,
I kind of take that
firecracker.
So, you know, just let it be known that, you know, everyone's replaceable.
I always believe that.
So, well, lots to talk about. Even though it's summer, middle of the summer, we still have lots to talk about. What is up with that?
Education never rests.
It never rests. Okay, we're going to play Pardon the Gadfly. We are going to have Amber's Research Minute, and Janie is going to rate that reform. Mickey, let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
All right. So last week, Mike, you and Checker published a piece in the National Review Online with the title of Why Conservatives Should Embrace National Standards.
That wasn't actually the title.
Okay, what was
the
exact
title?
Close enough.
Yeah. Well, in the Gadfly, it was more national standards even conservatives can love.
There you go.
The National Review shortened it to something else.
Should conservatives embrace national standards?
That was nicely said, Mickey. Nice and concise. I like that. So, yes, Checker and I published a piece in National Review last week, NRO, saying that, yes, the common standards are national standards conservatives can love. They're pretty good. They're not perfect, but they're pretty darn good standards, honor grades, according to our reviewers. They don't get into a lot of the nonsense that state standards and previous versions of national standards get into. They do things like expect kids to know their times tables and be able to handle fractions and learn phonics and study the founding documents. I mean, all stuff that conservatives should
embrace. But Jay Green came back at you guys with a pretty critical assessment saying, wait a minute, y'all are blind to the implementation challenges. You're blind to the fact that the unions are going to be all over this, and that it's that they're not really state-led, that it has been state-led in name, but pushed aggressively by the Obamas.
Right, and I think, you know, look, I think there's some, that's fair that certainly the states have done this under some coercion, and so we're going to find out, now that we know the finalists for Race to the Top, are some of these states that signed on, are they going to drop off now that they know they can't get the money? But, you know, at the same time, there were states that are not going after Race to the Top that we're signing on to, especially some smaller states that say, look, we were involved with this. It was a state-led effort. We've had input. And B, these are pretty good standards, better than we were able to develop on our own. And C, we're going to probably get a lot more resources in terms of teacher materials, et cetera, and good tests than we could afford to do on our own. So, look, the big question for the, you know, are these standards state-led? If you believe that they are, and I think they are fundamentally state-led, this is a state-led effort with some federal coercion, then you feel comfortable about it. If you think this is a federal takeover, then I understand the concerns of conservatives. But the question goes back to conservatives. Look, you really want to have the crappy standards that we have in place today in most states? You really want to make that case when we have a shot at something much better? I don't buy it. Okay, question number two.
Is President Obama's education policy political capital expended?
Rick, what do you think? All this Race to the Top movement, but also a lot of fighting with Congress over the plans for next year, spending, edgy jobs. What's going on?
You know, they're getting whipsawed by, A, the fiscal situation, where it's, you know, one of the reasons they were able to move Race to the Top in I-3, of course, was because it was $5 billion out of $100 billion that they were putting out there, so it was easy for them to bring the liberals along. They can't afford to spend $100 billion to get $5 billion anymore. B, as we get in reauthorization around ESEA, as we'll talk about in a minute, they're starting to get into some real silliness around some of the promises Duncan's making. He's going to require turnaround schools to have honest, transparent conversations with their communities. I don't know what any of this means. And third, frankly, the president was looking much better in the polls about 6 or 12 months ago, and his larger political position affects his ability to move the education agenda. Right now, the president's in trouble. That means he's got a lot less oomph to put behind controversial education proposals.
Yeah, you know, the battles continue to be within the Democratic Party mostly, partly because Republicans on the Hill are just saying no to everything. But, you know, you had this interesting dynamic. On the one hand, the EduJobs bill died, and there's this whole fracas with OB about trying to cut the current spent year's accounts for Race to the Top. On the other hand, both the House and Senate have now said that for 2011, there is going to be some money for Race to the Top. So it looks like there's probably going to be $600 or $700 million for that program going forward. So that was a victory for the administration. So I think that you know, the administration's down but not out on education, and getting some traction.
Yeah, although we'll actually see what happens to those numbers, especially after November.
Yeah. All right. Fair. Okay. Topic number three.
This week, the Department of Education announced the formation of an Excellence and Equity Commission to look into the reasons behind inequities in education and propose potential solutions. What do you make of that?
So I'm not sure what to make of it yet. I haven't seen too many details. I guess this was actually required by Congress in the 2010 appropriations bill. So I think it was an idea from the Hill, not the administration. More curious part, when this announcement was made as a part of a speech to the, I believe, the NAACP, Arne Duncan made some comment about how he's going to hold all schools accountable, including public, charter, and private schools accountable for serving disadvantaged kids.
Yeah, you blogged upon this earlier in the week, Mike, and I thought you made great points. I have no idea what the secretary's talking about.
I mean, how do you hold private schools accountable for that? If I was a private school right now, I'd be freaking out.
I mean, you know, I mean, the simple question here is somebody at the department needs to explain what the secretary means when he says he's going to hold private schools accountable for serving particular populations.
Yeah, it's a big question. All right. Well, that is all the time that we have for Pardon the Gadfly. Whew, Rick, I have to say we're a little rusty here. The mojo's not flowing quite.
Bringing
the same.
Bringing our B-minus game, baby. B-minus game.
But you know what always brings us up? You know what always brings us back to our best? It is Amber's Research Minute.
Bing. The pressure's on.
Amber, I hope this is good. I mean, we need something good today because it's been a little rough. I mean, I'm looking at for an MBER study, maybe. I'm looking for something gold standard.
It's Henry Braun, which, you know, Henry Braun tends to bring it.
He's good. Yeah.
He's a good guy.
Yeah, he's good. All right.
All right. So everyone knows that the 12th grade NAEP scores have been flatter than a pancake since the 1970s. We do know that. So why not pay kids and see if they do any better? This is the idea. Similar to what Roland Fryer team's been doing in a handful of big cities recently. This was a randomized control study, our favorite kind, conducted by measurement superstar Henry Braun from Boston College and his fellow ETS researchers. They looked at about 2,600 students in 59 schools in 7 states. These kids took the 12th grade reading NAEP test. So here were the three groups they were assigned to. One got a fixed payout of $20 at the beginning of the test session. The other group got $5 at the beginning and $15 at the end if they got two randomly selected questions correct, and then you have the control group. So in the end, they found that both groups who had the monetary incentive scored higher than the control group, particularly the second incentive where they got $5 at the beginning and then the $15 for each of the two they got right. They got a little bit higher than the other incentive group. So to put this in perspective, it was about 5 points higher than the control group, which doesn't sound like a lot, but basically they said that's about 1/4 of the achievement gap between black and white students in the control group. So that kind of helps out a little bit. So these findings basically add to others that show that student behavior and test performance can indeed be bumped via monetary incentives, even if that's a pretty costly concept.
Well, but hold on. The problem here is it doesn't actually mean anything. They don't know more. They just concentrated harder on the instrument.
Yeah. I mean, it seems to me that the question here is this question of, you know, why are 12th grade NAEP scores flat when at 4th and 8th they're going up? And one assumption, one hypothesis was that the kids just aren't trying hard.
Right.
They know
trying.
It doesn't count, so they're just not even trying. So this would get them to at least try harder on the test. And that might imply that actually our kids know more in 12th
exactly
grade than
right.
we thought, right?
That's right. That's why I crossed out the top.
All right. But it has nothing to do with the Roland Fryer kind of stuff.
But why do we care? I mean, if the only reason we're getting 12th grade rates to test scores to move up is because kids are paying more attention because we're paying them, it doesn't actually measure anything we care about.
No, but what if we paid everybody? So the point would be that the policy might need to be, look, if we want accurate indicator of how much 12th graders know on a low stakes test, we got to pay them to make it more of a high stakes test.
Or we can just calibrate off what we know they're getting when we pay them, which saves us lots of money.
Well, I guess so.
Yeah, I guess so. I think the implication here was that, can this be how would this look at other grades and that sort of thing in terms of, you know, an incentive. And yeah, that was exactly the, I mean, that was why it was so interesting at 12th grade, because we've got this theory that these kids could care less, you know, at 12th grade. It has nothing to do with high school graduation and that sort of thing. I mean, not that the, frankly, the incentive for a voluntary NAEP test isn't that great at 4th and 8th grade, but I guess the idea is that seniors, you know, are really could care less.
But I mean, but the difference here is, right, I mean, the capital gain stuff or what have you, mm-hmm. The idea is you're trying to use monetary incentives to encourage kids to change behaviors.
Right.
Right.
And to behave right. in ways.
Over the course of the whole year.
Paying kids so that they'll pay more attention when they take the test. It, you know, honestly, I mean, it's useful for policymakers.
Right.
In the terms of being able to go brag to voters that test scores are higher. Mm-hmm. But it has no substantive meaning.
I don't know. I don't quite. I guess I'm struggling with that a little bit, Rick. Because so Roland Fryer's stuff said, yeah, he saw some changes in the test scores, but he also saw some things based on task. So pay kids things they can control, like you read a bunch of books. Okay, you read a bunch of books. Hey, that happened to increase your achievement on the reading comprehension, you know, measure.
Right. But the idea is that, you know, those discrete payments. I mean, again, whether or not they work the way that people would hope is an open mm-hmm. question. But if they work, those kids have now read those books. Mm-hmm. All you are doing for this $20 is getting kids to pay more attention when they're filling in, well, you know, the answers on the assessment.
So I think the benefit is definitely just for policymakers. And it's to say,
right.
I mean, we have this big question. Why are we seeing gains in 4th and 8th grade and not in 12th grade? Mm-hmm. If you believe that's because kids are really not learning any more in 12th grade than they used to be, then that makes you really worried about high schools and yada, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. If they're actually doing just as well in 12th grade as they are in 8th grade, then that leads you down totally different policy.
Except
routes.
That we weren't paying them, right? So if we're making the longitudinal comparison, right, presumably, unless kids are becoming increasingly disengaged and less interested in academic work, mm-hmm. right, you'd assume that the downward bias for 12th graders today should be what it was historically. Mm-hmm. So now you're paying them, you're mm-hmm. creating an artificial bump.
Well, right.
So
well, that's true.
So you're actually not getting a continuous assessment.
I think all we can agree on right now is that we'd like to hear the song that goes along with this.
The song, since we're talking about kids getting paid, we've got a song from the 90s. You guys remember NSYNC, the boy band. Just Got Paid. I remember this. This is a good song.
Just got paid.
Just got paid.
Friday night. Party hopping.
Uh-oh.
Feeling right. Booty shaking.
You know, Rick, you and I, we should start a boy band, shouldn't we?
Mm. We got, at this point, it's got to be the middle-aged guys band.
You got the right haircut, though.
Oh, thank you.
You got to go.
Oh, yes. Me or Mike? Hold on, which one?
You. Oh. The Flock of Seagulls, you know, it's coming back.
Yeah, nice. That's what I'm saying.
Again, it's too bad that we don't have this. Maybe Laura can take a picture. We can put it up on the website. But, you know, Rick has now had an opportunity to have a haircut in about 2 months. And it is a very impressive amount of growth that you have here, I have to say. As somebody whose hair is thinning rapidly, I'm jealous. Okay, it is time for us to rate that reform. Janie, you know, you had such a star performance last week in the guest host role.
Thank you.
But you're still going to turn in something strong here from the Rate That Reform chair, aren't you?
Yeah, we'll see. You know, I don't want to get your expectations too high.
What is this? All right, come on. No more summer slump, people. Let's do it.
Okay. So this fall, Hawaii plans to move from pencil and paper tests to online state assessments. This will supposedly allow students to take tests in a comfortable, familiar medium, you know, present questions in ways that aren't possible on paper, like animation, computer graphics, and, you know, generally reduce teacher interaction with the test and ideally prevent teachers from tampering with scores. But in addition to the switch to the electronic format, Hawaii plans to administer tests repeatedly during an 8-month window between October and May, and it will allow students 3 chances to pass the test. Education officials hope that the opportunity to retake the test will lessen the pressure leveled on students by high-stakes tests and will provide teachers with real-time measures of student progress and achievement. No doubt, they also hope that, you know, with 3 chances, more students will get across the proficiency bar that, you know, is required by NCLB. So I can kind of guess what, you know, at least your reaction to this, Mike, will be, but I actually don't see this as a bad thing. Because it's obviously not important. I mean, it's important not to diminish the rigor of the test or, you know, to allow students so many chances that it just basically becomes meaningless. But it's also true that, you know, sometimes kids are having a bad day. And, you know, why not give them another chance, an opportunity to do better? We don't expect kids to take the SAT once and just kind of get stuck with that grade for the rest of their life. And, you know, having a measure of where you are can definitely be the best way to then improve upon it and do better. So I also think it'll provide a wealth of data for researchers just in terms of actually measuring, you know, meaningful measurements of students throughout a year. So it's not a perfect reform, but it's not bad. So I give it a B minus.
Mm. What do you think, Rick?
I got three related reforms. One, I think when baseball players strike out, they should be allowed to go up and start over with a fresh count.
They got three tries.
Two.
That's three tries.
Two, I think when basketball players miss a free throw, they ought to get an extra attempt each time they miss.
Usually sometimes they do.
And three, when pro golfers don't get a score they like on a hole, I think they should be allowed to go back and replay the hole.
There's a mulligan.
I don't know anything about golf.
I don't know, Rick. I don't know that any of your analogies hold up here. You're right that my initial instinct is that this is ridiculous. I mean, the way that I first heard about it was kind of pitched as, basically, kids can take the test up to three times, and the highest score counts, right?
Which is true. That is true.
I don't mind that, I guess, at the kid level in terms of saying, yes, these kids, and it's, you know, as long as they're not getting the same questions and, you know, there's new questions and all that stuff, right? But it makes me a little nervous about what that means for holding schools accountable and trying to judge the quality of schools. I mean, that just seems like that will greatly inflate school performance.
But if a student does that well on one day and, you know, maybe it took them a couple tries to get there, it still means that they're doing that well.
Yeah, I guess.
Well, not necessarily, right? Because you've got a degree of natural variation in the performance.
That's true.
And so if you're letting a kid keep trying until he gets one over the bar, I mean, right? If you take me down to a basketball court and I you have me throw up 150 shots from the top of the key, there's a great chance one of them will go in. Doesn't mean I'm a good shooter. It just means you give me enough chances. Mm-hmm. The odds are that one of them will accidentally find its way in.
And that's the thing. I don't think there should be so many opportunities to pass that it just becomes meaningless. You know, I think three is probably the limit. You can't really go much more than that. Because, then it just becomes chance. And
right. But you're not going to be able to distinguish among schools as easily. Mm-hmm. Because you're not going to know, you know, in this school, all the kids passed on their first try. And that implies that they're really getting it right. In this school, lots of the kids took three tries. And again, the random stuff came in. Well, it's interesting. I don't know. I still like to blast to Hawaii. Hawaii, again, one of the 19 states that's a race to the top finalist.
Everybody's a race to the top finalist.
Everybody's a finalist. That means by the administration's count, 21 states, that's 19 plus Tennessee and Delaware, are just doing path-breaking things in education reform. You buy that, Rick?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That was a cynical look. Okay, good. I'm glad we got that little bit in there at the end to blast away at the administration just a bit. Okay, Janie, thank you for rating that reform.
Thanks.
I think, you know, I actually like Janie's optimism. She makes a good case.
She does. And I think her grade's sensible. Was it B minus?
I gave it a couple tries first, you know. First time of the C, then I did it again. I was like, A, and then B minus.
Wound up, I think that works.
Not bad. C, superstar, right here.
Natural. She's a gift.
All right. Well, we'll be back next week. Till then.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show, signing off.